This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Osher Author Talk. I'm Henry DeVries with UC San Diego and the California Business Journal. Today's guest is Dr. John O'Brien. He is a licensed psychologist, a professional speaker, and the author of the book, Rudeness Rehab. Our topic today, dealing with difficult people. Let's jump into it. No doubt about it, we live in a rude world. In your book, you say it's a rudeness epidemic. But hasn't it always been a world like this? Haven't people always been rude?
Well, I'm going to present some data, Henry, that will illustrate that, in fact, there has been an increase in rude and uncivil behaviors. But I think what speaks more than words are actions. And we have a clip here from Inside Edition that illustrates just that.
How would you like to sit next to this commuter? Or this lady shaving her legs? Or this woman using a train as her personal gym? Passengers are getting fed up with such rude behavior.
Sign says no eating and drinking. You don't get it? You don't get it. You must be stupid.
I rode the Long Island Railroad in New York to see firsthand how rude passengers can get. So what gets under commuters' nerves?
People who kick the back of the chair. That's my worst one.
People putting their feet up, people leaving trash.
This is gross.
We saw plenty of trash thrown about. Beer cans, food wrappers, and even a banana.
Someone's going to slip on that.
Somebody could slip on that. It's dangerous.
Classic, yeah.
So my guess is that most of these people who were videoed doing this difficult behavior did not wake up that morning and think to themselves, how can I go out and irritate my fellow humans today, right? They were just kind of oblivious to the impact of their behavior, but nonetheless, it was quite difficult, and I would not want that to be my commute.
What's your number one strategy for dealing with difficult people?
You want my number one strategy?
I want
right
your number one strategy.
Okay, number one strategy. So here it is. I encourage people to ask themselves the following question. When you're faced with difficult behavior from some other person, ask yourself, how is this not about me? Of course, when other people's behavior is directed towards us, we want to make it about us and assume that it's about us. But if we can ask ourselves that question, it allows us to get unhooked from personalizing other people's behavior, which is going to give us a better perspective to try to respond.
Let me give you some pushback. How is it not always about us?
Well, true, yes. It's not always, not about us. It's the other end of the continuum. So, you know, psychologists are famous for giving the answer, it depends, to any question. But I'm going to use that one as a psychologist. So it depends, right? Sometimes it's not about us, but sometimes it may be about us. Now, if I was to ask you, Henry, which I will, but you don't have to answer, who are the people that you find most difficult to deal with in your life? Hopefully I would not be topping the list after preparing for this interview.
Right?
But we can all probably do that, right? Identify, I can easily remember who those difficult people are. Well, the newsflash is that for other people, we're on their list just by being ourselves. So sometimes we can't help it. It's just in who we are. We don't mesh with other people. But it also may be that there are things that we're doing or not doing that we need to bring to our awareness that could be contributing to the problem. So yes, it could be not about us, but it also could be about us.
Well, that's fair. But how does it work dealing with these difficult people in everyday life? What should we be doing?
Well, in terms of responding to, you mean like where does it show up?
Yes.
Is what you mean? Well, it can show up in a variety of places, right? So it can show up when we, sometimes just getting out of the bed in the morning. We may live with people, unfortunately, that we find difficult. I hope that's not the case. But along with that, it could be when you go to the store. It could be when you go to work. It could be when you're driving or out in public. It also can be when you're traveling, maybe going on vacation. And it could be when you go to take a flight And I think we've got a video here that illustrates that.
Okay, if you don't feel safe, get off the airplane.
But this is your captain speaking, okay. But never like this.
I'll stop, and we'll fly the airplane. Don't worry, I'm going to let my co-pilot fly it. He's a man. Okay?
It's a total meltdown. The pilot boarded in her street clothes and addressed the passengers over the intercom. Passenger Pam O'Neill couldn't believe what was happening.
She said, let's take a vote. How many of you would like to take off now with me dressed as I am, or would you prefer that I take 10 minutes to get changed into my cute little uniform? Then she started talking about her divorce and political candidates. And the minute she mentioned that, a gentleman stood up and just yelled, whoa, enough, you're scaring me.
Another passenger, Randy Reese, got up to leave and gave a running commentary on social media. I'm shaking right now. The captain demonstrated that she was not mentally in a safe space. She says, sorry, I'm going through a divorce. The pilot also insulted a mixed-race couple on board.
Did I offend you? Okay, so did I purposely offend you? I did. The answer is yes.
The more she tried to convince everyone she was okay to fly, the more people got off.
Flight attendants, please disarm doors.
So, travel is stressful enough, right? And imagine getting on a plane and having that as your pilot. Now, what I would also say is that the sad thing is this is clearly someone who needed help, and either she wasn't getting help or she wasn't getting adequate help. And that's actually a not uncommon story in our country these days. There's a shortage of mental health providers and access to mental health care. And so, in fact, there's a lot of people who aren't getting the care they need and who are out there with their stress-related negative behaviors kind of leaking on other people.
Dr. O'Brien, you're at UC San Diego this weekend to talk to the Business of Healthcare conference. And let's talk about healthcare. I mean, does this show up in healthcare, or what are some examples of rudeness in healthcare?
Well, there's certainly, our healthcare system is a sick system right now. There's a lot of problems in healthcare, and it's difficult for patients, it's difficult for the providers, and sometimes it's also the behavior of the providers that's the problem. Several years ago, my mom, who's still going strong at 89, let's give a shout out to mom. Hello, mom. So she was needing to have foot surgery, and she was 80 and in pretty good health, but she'd had some mild cardiac problems. So we met with the surgeon before surgery, and he said it'll be day surgery. Because these days, like, you have major cardiac surgery and they put you on a gurney and then they wheel you out to your car practically, right? I mean, it's with good reason. But so she was going to have day surgery and be sent home. And he said, now, unfortunately, her insurance doesn't cover a nurse. But we'll send out a physical therapist. And a physical therapist is the same thing, basically, as a nurse. Now, I have friends who are physical therapists. I have a cousin who's a physical therapist. I love physical therapists, but they're not nurses. And we really wanted my mom to have one. So that bothered me. And the day before her surgery, I finally had a chance to call her insurance company, and I learned a nurse would be covered. So great. So I called the surgeon's office in the afternoon before the surgery, and I said, we'd like to have a nurse come out. And in fact, I learned the insurance would cover that. Perfect. So the next day, my sister brought my mom in for the surgery, and she's in the pre-op room. And the surgeon came tearing into the pre-op room. He stood at my mother's bedside, pointed his finger at my sister, and he said the following. Apparently, you don't trust my ability to have knowledge of insurance. Maybe you don't trust my ability as a surgeon. Maybe this surgery's not going to happen at all. And out he stormed. At which point, my mom just got really, like, dizzy and overwhelmed. And my sister, who is less likely to cry than I am, burst into tears. A few minutes later, the charge nurse came in and she said, oh, don't worry, the surgeon has said he will do the surgery. Which he did, and all went well. And after the surgery, he came out to tell my sister that it all had gone well. And then he said, oh yeah, and about earlier, sometimes I just go pop. We learned later that that was his reputation, and so if we had known that, we might have chosen a different surgeon.
Okay, rude. We'll give you that. How common is rudeness in healthcare?
Well, it's actually, unfortunately, not an uncommon experience. And we have a video segment that will illustrate another example of rudeness in healthcare.
I was appalled, I was distraught, I was violated, thinking that I'm lying there naked after the surgery, and they have me still uncovered talking over my body like this.
And listen to this.
Precious, yes. This is Precious over here, saying hi to Precious over there.
Easter considered that to be a reference to the main character in the movie Precious.
It was racially profiling me, yes. I was offended by it.
Easter says she decided to secretly record her surgery after a tense meeting with the doctor.
She said some choice words to us in clinic when we didn't book her case within 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Including, I'm going to call a lawyer and file a complaint. It just doesn't seem like the thing to say to the person that's going to do your surgery.
So this is another example, obviously, from healthcare. And I always used to say to my clients who were going to be going through surgery, you don't really need to worry about the surgeon's bedside manner because you're going to be unconscious, right? And you want a technician. But there's actually research now that shows that the behavior of the surgeon in the surgery with the other staff, the greater the level of incivility, the more likely that the patient is going to experience medication errors, medical errors, complications post-surgery, and there's even a higher rate of mortality as a result of the surgery. So it really matters how healthcare providers are behaving.
In your research for the book, what did you find is behind this surge in rudeness and incivility?
Well, there's a number of factors. You heard a little bit about that in the setup piece, that Americans are experiencing some of the highest stress levels ever recorded. The American Psychological Association does an annual survey, Stress in America, that will come out next month. And continuing these last several years are seeing high levels of stress. So there's high stress. There's also what someone would describe as a pandemic of loneliness in our society. There was a book written in 2001, not published by Indy, unfortunately, but entitled Bowling Alone. And it was about the decline of people's participation in community bowling leagues that also matched with a decline in people's participation in organized religion and other community groups. And so the loneliness and people's disconnection means it's easier to engage in othering of people when you have less social contact. Speaking of othering, social media. People get onto social media and will be saying all kinds of nasty things because you're just doing it to a computer screen. And people think when they get on social media that they are actually releasing their frustrations, but what psychological research shows is people are simply rehearsing their frustrations, which only grows their level of anger. We then have media. And when I was growing up, a billion years ago, you know, we had evening news that was 1 hour, right? There was an hour, and then there was maybe like around midnight, there was Nightline if you wanted to see a specific story. Now we have 24/7 cable news. Any time of the day you can turn it on, and their job is to grab eyeballs, right? They want to say outrageous things to grab listeners and get your attention, and that also then feeds sort of people's, you know, outrage, which leads to incivility. And then finally, politics. Henry, did you know that our politics are rather divided at this point?
I hadn't heard.
Oh, yes. Well, that's what I wanted to make sure you knew.
Thank
right?
you.
Which is that, you know, we live in a very divided time politically. Research shows, though, that although we want to think that it's one side or the other, most people fall somewhere in the middle in terms of their belief systems. About 84% of people are somewhere on the continuum, but that's getting lost with the people at the extremes on either end that are speaking. So those are just some of the factors that are contributing to the upsurge in incivility.
Thank you. We've talked about healthcare, we've talked about travel. Let's talk about the workplace. So is this impacting business at all?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, when Christine Porath, who's really the leader in the field of research on incivility. When she started doing research, as she has for about 20 years now, in 2005, she asked workers if they had experienced incivility in their workplace in the last month. And she found that about 50% of workers said that they had. When she repeated that research in 2022, that number was 76%. And 70% of workers said that they'd experienced rudeness and incivility three or more times in the last month. More recently, the Society of HR Management has been collecting data every month and every quarter on the incidence of incivility in our society. Similarly, they've found 77% of workers experiencing, and the numbers just keep going up. But what really grabs businesses' attention is that their research says that incivility in the workplace costs businesses $2 billion every day. So there's a huge problem that businesses are now recognizing that they need to address.
$2 billion here, $2 billion there. Pretty soon that adds up to a lot of money.
Exactly.
Yeah. But let's talk about the term. How do you define incivility?
Thank you for asking. Because it's actually a term people don't know a lot about. And I checked this again just prior to this interview today. And if you go into Amazon to do a search on incivility, it autocorrects to invisibility, which I think is a great metaphor for the fact that this is something that people don't even know what it means, never mind understand its impact. So the way that I define incivility is that it's rude and inconsiderate behavior that may be seen as inconsequential, but that creates stress in the target of the behavior, in people witnessing the interaction, and even boomeranging back ultimately to the person who is her or himself being uncivil.
What are the different kinds of incivility you're seeing out there?
So there's three general categories. The first is what we would probably think of most commonly, which is interpersonal. So these are when you're in a group and someone says something and another person makes a sarcastic, demeaning, dismissive comment, rolls their eyes or sighs when someone says something. So that's interpersonal. The next is cyber. We just talked about social media, right, and the impact of social media. But cyber incivility can also be when people are making negative comments in the chat in a Zoom meeting about the presenter or other people, or posting negative comments in a Slack account, or sending a pointed email or text message, or not realizing the impact of that, the difference between the intent of an electronic communication via text message or email and how it actually lands with the other person. Cyber incivility can also be someone needs a report by 5 p.m. because they need to submit something, a larger report, and the person waits until 5:05 to send it. So that's interpersonal cyber, but my favorite, not that I do this, but my favorite I think is most interesting is something called victimless incivility. That's basically, as we saw in the setup piece today, with people leaving trash behind them. So in a workplace, it could be leaving your dishes in the sink for somebody else to find, or leaving the photocopier jammed. The message is, my time is more valuable than yours, and you can just clean up after me. So we've got interpersonal, cyber, and victimless.
Well, then we just put a note in the kitchen that your mother doesn't work here, and then that escalates to more rude behavior, and we get stress. So let's talk about the connection between rudeness and stress.
It's a chicken and egg situation. So there's a phenomenon in psychology that's called the feel-good, do-good phenomenon. So when we're in a good mood, we are more likely to treat others well. Unfortunately, the other end of the continuum is possible as well. When we're irritable or in a bad mood, we are more likely then to treat others poorly because of our stress. And then being treated poorly creates stress in you, which then leads to greater levels of rude and uncivil behavior. And in office places, that's why there can be uncivil behavior can spread like the flu. It's because the interaction between stress And in civility, they feed off each other.
So this stress feeds off more stress, which compounds. Tell me more about the negative effects of that compounding of stress.
There's a famous book in the trauma recovery field by someone named Bessel van der Kolk that's entitled, The Body Keeps the Score. So traumatic stress is the extreme end, but that's also relevant for any type of stress. It's going to get locked in our body. So in the short term, that can create physical symptoms when people experience stress from rudeness of things like headaches, stomach aches, sleep disturbance, concentration problems, can also create feelings of despair, of frustration, or anger. In the longer term, in chronic situations, that can lead to physical health consequences, such as cardiovascular disease, cancers, immune system problems, or other more serious things that we talked about a little bit earlier, like clinical depression, anxiety that we're seeing skyrocketing, or also substance abuse. And I think actually we've got a video clip that illustrates this a little bit further.
Most everyone, I think, has felt, you know, rudeness at one point or another from a coworker. And it turns out, Avery, that it could be more serious than we thought. It could indeed have some long-lasting health effects. There was a joint study out of the University of Calgary and the London School of Economics, and they sort of define this rudeness as things like, you know, deviant behavior. You're walking by someone, you don't say hello. You talk over someone in a meeting. And they found out that that can lead to things like stomach problems, headaches, sleeplessness, long-term problems like that, which can actually cost the company money. Of course, not good for you as a person. So, you know, it goes a long way to be nice around the office.
So I just wanted to bring something else to sort of back up what I'm saying. There's a lot of research that just makes that connection between rudeness and the health of individuals and workers.
In your book, you talk more about how it's impacting the health. Is there anything more that we should know about this connection?
Well, I sort of alluded to it just a minute ago that we have skyrocketing rates of chronic disease in our society. 60% of Americans have at least one chronic disease. 40% have two or more chronic diseases. You look at the rates of cancer. The U.S., in comparison to 212 other countries, we score number one. We're number one, in not a good way, of our rate of cancer. And we are double the rate of cancer of the next country on the list. Between 1990 and 2021, our rate of cancer increased 88%. But what really matters, I think what really gets people's attention, is life expectancy. And when you compare the United States to other developed countries, we are 4 years behind on average in terms of our longevity of life, just the average of other countries. We die 4 years earlier. And interestingly, that also depends upon where you live in the United States, because there's a 20-year difference, that's 2-0, 20-year difference based on the county that you live in the United States, how long you live. So there are some long-lasting health effects. And obviously there's a lot that goes into life expectancy, but one of the things is the stress from rudeness.
There you go. And what else are the other impacts on business? Because you talk more about that in the book too.
Yes. I think that, you know, businesses experience problems from workers who are feeling frustrated in a toxic work culture. If you go to work and you are demeaned or dismissed, then you're not going to speak up, right? You're actually just going to be less likely to offer your opinion. And that without that psychological safety, businesses suffer. People are not speaking up. And ultimately, that can lead workers to feel demotivated, disconnected, and to see a decline in their productivity. It leads businesses to reduced profitability, and it can even lead to the demise of a business. And I have a story about that to illustrate that.
Do tell.
How about that, right? So several years ago, on a Friday night, my partner and I decided we were going to go out to dinner, and we selected a new restaurant that had recently opened to great acclaim. We arrived at the restaurant, and we were greeted by someone who turned out was the owner. She was funny, friendly, she had a great sense of humor and an infectious laugh, and she talked quite animatedly about how excited she was to be opening this restaurant. We wished her well, ordered our meals, I grabbed my exciting beverage for Friday night, of a water, from the cooler, and we headed on out to the far end of the patio to await our meals to be delivered. And we were seated for about 90 seconds when all of a sudden I became aware of a disturbance on the patio coming from the side of the restaurant, and I was wondering what was going on. Someone was yelling, and I turned and looked, and it was the owner, and she was yelling and pointing, and she was coming at me. And she said, "I don't know who you think you are, but where I come from, taking something you haven't paid for is stealing, and I won't have it." Now, let me just freeze this here. So I teach people mindfulness. So you would assume, right, that I would respond in the situation like a mindfulness leader, right?
Sure, like the Dalai Lama.
Like the Dalai Lama. Except if I were to tell you that, it would not be a true story, right? Because John here does not like someone falsely accusing me or also trying to publicly humiliate me. So I stood up and I said, "I'm sorry, I didn't know I hadn't paid for this water. It's not my job to supervise your workers. And frankly, I don't like the way you're talking to me." And I continued to sputter as I followed her into the restaurant, and I paid my $1.50 for the water. And friends said, "So you left immediately, right, John?" And I said, "I'm a frugal New Englander. We're gonna stay and get our money's worth," which I did, and the meal was delicious. But when we left the restaurant that day, we knew we were never going back. And lots of people in that patio witnessed that interaction, and my guess is most of them didn't go back either, because a few months later, that restaurant closed. That owner's negative stress-related behavior cost her business.
That's sad. Sad to hear. You talk about problems here, but in your book, you talk about solutions. And you're a mental health professional, and you give mental health advice on how to deal with this. What type of approach are you advocating?
I encourage people to try to feel more empowered when it comes to dealing with difficult behavior in others. We can't change what other people are doing, but we can change what we're doing, and both in how we respond, but also how we react internally to what other people are doing. So taking a mental health approach means that you try to focus on what you can do. You know, there's an old saying that I'm going to paraphrase, which is, "Resentment is the poison I drink, thinking it will harm you." The more stirred up you are about someone else, it's not going to hurt them, it's going to hurt you. So I think taking a skills-based approach allows people to feel more empowered, help them stay calm, and to figure out how they're going to be able to effectively respond to a challenging situation.
Well, give us some specific examples or things we can do, let's say in the workplace, to deal with this.
Well, for workers, there's a whole lot to say, but in summary, what I would say is I think people have to determine, first of all, is it something like we talked about earlier, is it something I'm doing or not doing that might be contributing to this behavior from someone else? But barring that, think about, is this a one-off? Is this difficult behavior something that is unusual for this person, or do I always seem to have struggles with this person? If I have a good working relationship with them, maybe I can go to them and try to address it. But if I don't, then maybe I need to get the advice of my boss or maybe human resources. Those could be helpful resources. Unfortunately, I've known people who've gone to their boss to talk through some things, and a few months later, it's come up in their performance review that they don't play well with others in the workplace. So it may be more effective to talk to people outside your organization, a mentor, hire a coach. So getting feedback from others, often outside your workplace, about what to do.
Well, let's talk about all of us. What can we as individuals do when we're dealing with difficult people?
Well, I'm on a mission to turn all of us into superheroes, okay? Do you want to be a superhero?
I'm signing up now.
Okay, good. How about the audience? You guys ready to be superheroes?
Yes.
Excellent, good, okay. So, wow, what a great audience, right? How enthusiastic. So, you know, in Marvel Comics, when the hero is trying to fend off the villains, whoever they are, you see the acronym BAM, BAM, BAM. So we're going to talk about that acronym BAM, which in regard to rude behavior stands for breathing, active listening, and mindfulness.
For a minute, I thought we were going to go to fisticuffs. So, okay. So BAM, let's break it down. Let's take the acronym one at a time. What's the B stand for?
So B is for breathing. And it's not like you're going to get somewhere and think, "Oh, shoot, I forgot my lungs," right? They're always with us. They're always at the capacity. And I was glad I had my lungs a few years ago when I met the wolf in sheep's clothing. So I had finished doing a 6-hour presentation at the end of a very long week. I had driven 2 hours outside of Portland to do the talk. And it was at the end of the day, and people were coming up to say thank you or to ask questions. And there was this woman who caught my attention before I even started talking to her, because she just beamed. She had this glow about her. She had a beautiful long hair, beautiful expression, big eyes, and a really wonderful smile. And she came up and she said to me, "Oh, John, I really enjoyed your talk." And I said, "Yeah?" She said, "Yeah. Of course, once I got beyond your incredible sense of narcissism, I really learned a lot." So I said, my narcissism? She said, "Yeah, you were telling all these stories from your life." I'm thinking I should be telling stories from your life. But at any rate, luckily I had my lungs with me and I was able to breathe through it as she left. But breathing is something that's always with us. People may be familiar with diaphragmatic breathing, or what's called yoga breathing, right, where you fill your lungs completely. And when you do, your stomach pushes out, right? And that gives you the full capacity of your lungs. And you're such a great group. I hear some people out there breathing already, right? So we don't normally breathe that way, but that's a great way to breathe. But there's something from Huberman Labs that's called the physiological sigh. So it uses those same mechanics, but what it does is it uses a specific breathing technique to give you fast relief. And here it is. So I'll demonstrate. You breathe in through your nose, and then you take a second sniff, and then a long exhale. Let me demonstrate first. Such a great group. You're ahead of me, right? So here we go. We'll go. Okay. Let's try that once more all together. You ready? Inhale. Sniff. Exhale. Great. Nice breathing. Okay. So just doing a few of those, according to Huberman Labs, there's research to say that helps to center us and helps us then to be more effective in responding to difficult behavior.
Great. So A, what does the A stand for?
A, thanks for asking. A is for active listening. Now, listening is a lost art in our society right now, because often when people are in conversation like you and I are, when one person is talking, the other person is already thinking about what they're going to say. So when we are listening, we are not talking. So many years ago, when I was in school, and I went to a small Catholic school, I was 6 years behind my older sister, who was a talker. A talker, talker, talker. She still loves to talk. And every year I would go in hoping that maybe the nun I would be working with that year would not remember the connection. But it was the same every year. I would go in and the nun would line us up along the side of the classroom like we were in a police lineup. And then she would call our name, and when she called my name, she would say, "O'Brien, you have a sister, right? Carol, she talks too much. Don't do that. Now sit down," right? Every year. So about the same time, when I was about 8 or 9, my parents took us to an arcade. And we were given a certain number of quarters to use. So I was convinced I was going to win that big stuffed animal by doing skee-ball. And unfortunately, my beliefs about my skee-ball ability far exceeded my actual ability. So I didn't come away with any winning. But my sister, being older and wiser, diversified her use of quarters until she was down to the last quarter. And she decided that quarter was going to go into the magic fortune teller machine. So she put the quarter in the magic fortune teller machine, and the machine came to life. And it started to move and rattle, and the figure inside was moving, and lights were flashing, and we all stood there and waited for her life-changing advice. And it came out, and it still lives in infamy in our family to this day. The wise old owl sat in an oak. The more he listened, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't you be like that wise old bird? So now, if my sister were here, she'd be screaming, "Boo, get some new material," okay? But listening and not talking is important. And when we are engaged in active listening, we are saying things to not respond to the content of what someone else has said, but to actually try to encourage them to continue to talk. So we'd be saying things like, "What do you mean? How so? say more. By doing that, you're getting the other person to rephrase what they've said, and sometimes that raises their awareness that they've been rude. But if not, at least what it does is it buys you a little time to be thinking about how you're going to respond. So that's the A for active listening.
I want to go back to the rude arcade fortune teller. Well, no, we don't have time, but rude. Let's go to M, the M in the formula.
So M is the last, but mind stands for mindfulness. And I think there's a lot of people using mindfulness, and maybe it gets to be an overused term. But I would not, I would encourage people, don't toss it out. It has a lot of power in it, but also don't get intimidated by it. Years ago, when I was first learning mindfulness, I was learning it as part of a training program on something called dialectical behavior therapy. And when I went to this five-day training, mindfulness was integrated throughout. And they were having us do all kinds of different activities. And on this particular day, the instructor said, okay, now everybody get up. It's just around the lunchtime. Before we go to lunch, we're going to do some mindful walking. So you're going to walk one behind the other silently. Now, people are not to talk, and you're going to be totally focused on walking. And I thought to myself, I got this. Right? I've been walking all my life. This is not going to be a problem. So I was perfect at walking mindfulness for about 8 seconds. And then my attention started to go to, look at these other people who are so much more focused than I am. I can't believe this. And I'm looking at my friend Emily, who's ahead of me, and gosh, Emily's more focused too. I can't do this. And as if it couldn't get any worse, the leader then decided to take our show on the road, quite literally, and out the door he went. And we were on a major thoroughfare in Portland, where I am from, right across from my gym. 100 people walking along, single file, saying nothing. So I just was thinking, oh no, who's driving by? Who's seeing me? And then I'm realizing the gym is right there, and I'm thinking all my friends, Ted and Mary Lou and Dave, are looking out the window like, look, look, there's this group out there. John has joined them. What's going on over there? So I was completely distracted. And when I got back inside and we processed it, I confessed that I'd been completely unfocused and I'd failed. But fortunately, I had a leader who was much more supportive and said, you know, John, no, you didn't, because you knew where your mind was, right? So you can't fail mindfulness. It's just about knowing where your attention is at. And as far as a mindfulness strategy that people can use when it comes to dealing with rude behavior, I encourage the four-step mindfulness. There's the Texas two-step, there's the mindfulness four-step. Four steps are stop, breathe, reflect, and choose. So when faced with rude behavior on the part of other people, stop. Next, breathe to calm yourself, and you're all experts in that now about breathing. The reflect part is to think about what's going on in the situation. And I encourage people to ask themselves the question, who do I want to be? Who do I want to be after this interaction is over? And what's really important? And then having reflected on that, then choose the behavior that you want. So stop, breathe, reflect, and choose. So you are now all superheroes and fully empowered to deal with the rude people you may encounter with the acronym BAM.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.